This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
The Sam and Rose Stein Institute for Research on Aging is committed to advancing lifelong health and well-being through research, professional training, patient care, and community service. As a nonprofit organization at the University of California San Diego School of Medicine, our research and educational outreach activities are made possible by the generosity of private donors. It is our vision that successful aging will be an achievable goal for everyone. To learn more, please visit our website at aging.ucsd.edu.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm thrilled to be here today. And I'm going to be talking about healthy longevity and healthy aging. And you know, they say that the keys to a long life are eating healthy, exercise, lots of sleep, or as my patients will like to refer to it as, three things I plan to start tomorrow. So I want to begin by talking a little bit about my dad, Irving Sachs, as he was really instrumental in my life. He was born in 1915, and he grew up during the Great Depression. He was an older dad. He was in his mid-40s when I was born, and if he were alive today, he'd be approaching his 109th birthday. He went to law school on the eve of World War II, and he completed it just as the war was starting. And he was immediately pulled into counterintelligence training at Georgetown University. He trained in German language and all kinds of things that quite fascinating. And he entered the German theater at the end of the war. And while he was there, he bore witness to concentration camps that had just been recently liberated, saw walking scarecrows of human beings. And he stayed on in Germany during the occupation after the war, and he became a Nazi hunter. He was the co-director of denazification in the German state of Bremen, and he became an assistant to the prosecution at the Nuremberg trials. And after the war, he came back to the States, and my family, he started our family with my mom, and then some years passed, and my dad was always, I was always at his knee, learning about these things, learning how much it impacted him and his view of the world, and he was dedicated to me, he was my protector, and he was my champion. And this is a picture of the old Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, where I grew up and where my parents lived. And it was where my dad was diagnosed in 1981 with an unusual type, a fairly rare type of urological malignancy. We were told by Patrick Walsh, the chair of urology at Johns Hopkins, that my dad's prognosis, this is after surgical removal or attempt thereof, the prognosis was in months. He probably wouldn't survive a year. We were told, well, I did have one patient who survived for almost 3 years, but you know, that wasn't good enough for me. This was my dad, my protector, and I was not going to let go without a fight. So I went down to the medical library, several stories underground at Johns Hopkins, and I immersed myself looking on the old microfilm machines. This is beginning of the 1980s, before they even had personal computers in the libraries. And I was searching for anything I could find on cancer in general, my dad's specific type, anything that could provide us hope. Attributes, I was searching for attributes of long-term cancer survivors. Was there something we could learn from them that could help? Or causes of spontaneous remission. My dad was not a candidate for any further treatment. And at this point, I was open to anything. And it was in this context that I chanced upon the story of Anthony Satellaro. Dr. Tony Sadolaro. And Dr. Sadolaro was a physician, an anesthesiologist, and the president of Methodist Hospital in Philadelphia. And I came across this incredible story, I believe it was on the Saturday Evening Post, on copied on the microfilm, where it described how he had been dying of widespread prostate cancer. It had spread throughout his bones, sternum, to the ribs, and to his brain. And he had already had surgical removal and surgical castration, and he had already exhausted all available treatments, and he was dying. And by chance, he happened to learn about, got introduced to, and adopted a whole food, plant-based diet, a fairly strict one, rooted in some of the teachings of classical Chinese medicine. And he started taking meals with a local community of folks who cooked and ate that way. Within a few weeks of starting this overhaul of his diet, he noticed that the pain he had been having round the clock, for which he had been taking narcotics constantly, had gone away entirely. Several months later, he had gained weight. He was losing weight, cachexic, and he had gained weight, and his health had turned around dramatically. And he then went back for repeat scanning, and they found that all of the cancer had disappeared from his brain and his bones. The only thing left were areas of scarring in the bones where space-occupying lesions had previously been. Dr. Sadolaro's story was written up, as I said, in Saturday Evening Post, Life magazine, later in the books Recalled by Life, Living Well Naturally. So with my dad's blessing, Sadolaro had had his recovery in the 1970s. This is the beginning of the 1980s. I was just out of college, and my dad is at Johns Hopkins Hospital recovering from his cancer surgery. And with his blessing, he said, I want you to go up to a conference, an upcoming conference, and meet Dr. Sadolaro. Find out what you can. So I did. And when I went there, I encountered a number of people, not just Dr. Sadolaro, with similar incredible stories to tell. And I changed my own diet then and there, and I came back home and I shared my observations with my parents. They were understandably skeptical, but I urged them to give it a try, and with my support, they began to make dietary changes. You know, half measures at first, but gradually improving. At the 5-year mark, my dad was still alive, amazingly. Now, at that point, he had already become Johns Hopkins' longest-lived patient with that particular type of cancer. But it was also at the 5-year mark that he experienced a relapse, an overt relapse of what had been microscopic. And so he didn't have good treatment options, and so he decided to really go full bore. And he tightened up his diet, and he did it by the book for the next couple of months. At the end of that time, he went back, and he had a biopsy. He had a repeat biopsy. And they discovered that the cancer had gone away. There was no sign of the cancer by several different measures, including biopsy. And he experienced a spontaneous remission of the cancer. Not a cure, but a remission. And as it turned out, he lived for about 10 years in total, far outliving his prognosis. And most of that time, he had a really good quality of life. He traveled, he spent time with family, he attended senior lectures at places, the Osher didn't exist then, but places like that at the University of Maryland. And he had this pesky nuisance, this cancer that he had to deal with follow-ups every now and then. Toward the very end, his health declined. It was mainly confined to the last few months of his life. And when he did die, he did so on his own terms. In the last few weeks of his life, he was in the hospital, and during that time, he called to his hospital bed, one at a time, his brother and his two favorite cousins. And each one he kind of gathered over and he said, listen, I know I'm going, he said, but I want to have a really good funeral, and I want you, and each one he said, I want you to deliver a eulogy at my funeral. Not just any eulogy, I want one filled with wit. With humor and with lies. Nice. That was my dad. And so my dad had urged me, and before he died, He had urged me to go on with my own training, and I really undertook most of my career in my dad's memory. My training in nutrition science, then in public health, epidemiology and epidemiologic research, and later in medicine. And in that process, I studied the leading causes of death, and the literature in particular, the literature on two of the leading causes of death, heart disease and cancer. And I conducted my own research, several different studies on diet and cancers of the pancreas, breast, and prostate. I also, in the process, learned about the wisdom of the ancients, those who lived before the modern era of biomedicine, but who had great understanding of health and its determinants. And I studied a good bit also about the science of aging. So this chart shows us, as you can see, those two green sections at the front. The darker one is heart disease, the lighter one is cancer, and that's more than half of all deaths are those two diseases. So let's take a little deeper dive, in particular at diet. Heart disease is thought to be very much a nutritional disease. Other lifestyle factors also contribute. And the antidote, in some ways, I see as a whole food, plant-based diet, one high in unprocessed foods that is wholesome and doesn't mean it has to be vegetarian or strict vegan, but is based in plant food and wholeness. And this type of diet has been shown to improve lipid profiles, to optimize blood pressure, and one of the best markers we have of diabetes, type 2 diabetes, A1C, to decrease inflammation, to enhance the functioning of the endothelial cells that line our blood vessels, and to decrease the overall risk of heart disease. Adoption of this type of diet has been shown to help reverse existing coronary artery disease, within a few weeks to a few months, to increase cardiac perfusion, to decrease the risk of heart attacks, MIs, and other coronary events, and to serve as a low-cost alternative to coronary bypass and reperfusion like stents. This is an example. It comes from the practice of Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, a surgeon from the Cleveland Clinic. It's one of his patients who we put on a very intensive whole food plant-based dietary approach. The side of the slide to the left shows the LAD, the left anterior descending, the most prominent blood vessel feeding the most important part of the heart. And when people have a heart attack in that blood vessel, it's often referred to as the widowmaker. And you can see, just it's obvious that the patient had a very stenotic, very closed up LAD with poor blood flow when he met Dr. Esselstyn. And after 32 months of intensive dietary change, the vessel had returned to almost complete normal patency. And there are a number of other cases like this who have had these kinds of results and randomized clinical trials by Dean Ornish that show the reversibility of heart disease. Not 100%, but it's contingent on how dedicated people are to their practice. You've probably never seen this guy, but many years ago, he had had bypass for heart disease, and the bypass grafts were starting to fail, and he knew he didn't have good alternatives. And so he turned to Dr. Esselstyn and Dr. Ornish and completely overhauled his diet. And he's alive, and as I understand, relatively well to this day. And I think it made a huge difference for him and for others. Now, up until the time of my dad's experience, I had the idea that most diseases, especially cancer, just got zapped on us out of the blue by just poor luck, the damage from like a bolt out of the blue to our DNA. And yet, after my dad's experience, when I looked at this, I realized, no, there's huge, huge, inexplicable differences in different types of cancer. Here's a chart that shows us the differences between China, Sweden, and the United States. And you see the rate of invasive prostate cancer in the United States at the time this was done was over 100 times higher than in China. And in rural China, that's still the case. Most of the large cities in China have westernized their diet and their heart disease has gone up, or their prostate cancer has gone up. But at this time, when this was done, it was a dramatic difference. And not explained by PSA testing, because these data were from before PSA screening tests, and not explained by age differences, they're age adjusted. Something is different between these populations. So based on that and the experience with Dr. Sadolaro, I undertook two different studies, one when I was in residency at UMass and the other here, my early days at UCSD. And these data in this graph show the experience of patients in the second study, the one at UCSD. And in that study, we took men who had prostate cancer that had spread beyond the prostate. They had already had surgery, surgical removal, and yet their PSA, which should have been zero if the prostate had been removed and the cancer confined within it, there should have been no detectable PSA. Their PSA rates were increasing over time. And so we looked at their PSA rates, which is a rough measure of the rate of spread of the cancer in their bodies at this point. And then we enrolled them in a strict diet and lifestyle intervention with a whole food plant-based diet, stress reduction. I taught them classes in Tai Chi and meditation, and we had others teach as well. And we really got them to change. And you see, each pair of bars is a subject before and after. The light blue before the study, and then the maroon after, during and after. And you can see in almost every single case except for maybe one, the PSA rate went down. And in several cases, it went negative, meaning suspected shrinkage of the volume of cancer in the body. I also wanted to share a little bit about what I was learning during this time about the wisdom of the ancients. Many societies around the world had philosophies and developed approaches to care for people who aren't well and to promote health and healing. But perhaps the most fully evolved, detailed of these was that which was found in traditional Chinese medicine. Many of the core principles of traditional Chinese medicine, some would say classical Chinese medicine, are outlined in the treatise called The Yellow Emperor's Classic of Medicine. And in this book was written over 2,000 years ago during the Han Dynasty, and it was a foundation, a font of information for traditional Chinese medicine, the practice to this day. It consists of a series of dialogues between the Yellow Emperor and his personal physician, where they discuss all attributes of health and healing. And one core principle that I've taken from that is that health can be seen, as expressed in that book, as a constantly changing state of balance, a dynamic state of balance. And it's between a person and the outer environment. As the outer environment changes, we change inside to stay well. We don't get thrown off balance. And it's also a balance that's achieved between all the different parts of our body, our mind, our emotions, our spirit. A more recent discussion of this was written by the author Qi Su about a little over 50 years ago, where he made it maybe a little more comprehensible to those of us from the West. And he described ancient Taoist dietary and health practices, again, to promote health and long life. Chang Ming means long life. Longevity, he said, isn't complicated. And he said, don't be fooled by silver bullets, the latest and greatest, you know, supplement or device or whatever. He said, long life and good health is the result of living in harmony with nature, in accord, in balance with the seasons. And it's, again, it's a dynamic state of balance between the ever-changing and opposing energies of yin and yang. So again, Chang Ming emphasized eating simple, unprocessed, mostly plant-based foods, engaging in mindful, moderate exercise, movement, aiming to achieve a balance between work and stress, fostering inner tranquility, protecting and cultivating the qi, the life energy and the spirit. We turn now to modern science, what it tells us about aging. Well, many diseases have been linked with aging, heart disease, cancer, and so forth. Aging has effects, as I'm sure we all know, appreciate, on many different systems in the body. On the musculoskeletal system, decrease in the density and the mass and volume of bone, increased brittleness, increased risk of fracture. decreased muscle strength, size, tone, increased tendency to fatigue, and decreased tolerance for exercise, stiffer, less flexible joints, loss of cartilage, more stooped posture, loss of height as the spine shortens. On the immune system, the slower response against pathogens like bacteria and viruses, an increased risk of infection, therefore, decreased effectiveness of vaccines, slower rate of healing from wounds, an increased risk of autoimmune diseases, and an increased risk of cancer. On the brain, and this is an area many people are interested in as well, there's decreased blood flow to the brain, and the brain actually shrinks with each decade of life a little bit. There's a loss of brain cells, decreased production of neurotransmitters like serotonin, increased production in some of beta amyloid, which is a protein implicated in Alzheimer's disease, a decline of attention, multitasking, short-term memory, word finding. I have that sometimes myself. And yet, interestingly, a possible flourishing of verbal reasoning, ability to see and make connections disparately between things that maybe you had learned before, but now you see their interconnections, increased emotional satisfaction, and wisdom. Interesting. So now the science of aging. What can be done to slow the aging process? Well, there are a lot of Johnny-come-latelys, you know, green tea, pomegranate juice. We read about these as the latest and greatest. And yet, of all the things studied, perhaps the one that has been most strongly demonstrated is caloric restriction, something that occurs naturally if you adopt a whole food plant-based diet. You know, a properly balanced one will reduce your caloric intake by about 30%. Caloric restriction is the singular most effective way to slow aging, at least in animals. It increases the lifespan by an average of 30 to 40%. Decreased reduction in the diseases of aging, slows and may reverse cancer progression in animals, demonstrated in a variety of species, from worms to rodents, dogs, and possibly, although the data is not fully complete, even in primates. And if it applies in all these species, good chance it applies in humans. And here is something that shows us what is the impact of caloric restriction on survival in mice. And you can see that with a small amount of restriction of calories, 10%, survival goes up by significant, modest, but significant percentage. With more profound caloric reduction, quite an increase. Something that if applied to humans, perhaps could add decades to our lives. So other evidence-based recommendations scientifically, healthy diet, exercise, we need a balance of aerobic, weight-bearing, balance, flexibility, and so forth, avoiding smoking, these are obvious, limiting alcohol, getting enough sleep, reducing stress, keeping the mind active. Everybody here today, good work. Fostering social connection. And this is also echoed in the work of Dan Buettner in the Blue Zones, places that are believed to have long-living, healthy populations around the world, one in Loma Linda, not far from here. Common characteristics of the folks living in the Blue Zones, minimizing stress. They don't even think about, doing stress reduction. It's just how they live. They have calm, easy lives. They don't think about exercise per se as much as just moving regularly as part of daily life. They don't think about joining a support group. They have a clear sense of purpose already in their families and their connections. And their diet, they don't spend a lot of time dwelling on it, but they mostly eat a plant-based diet. So some of my takeaways, the emerging keys to health and longevity. Our genes are not our destiny. Many people think that they have a fatalistic attitude and think that, it runs in my family, or there's nothing I can do. I disagree. Now, Western medicine has reduced many of the causes of premature death, perinatal mortality, childbirth, infection, trauma. Most people today die from chronic diseases, heart disease, cancer, stroke, and so forth. And yet, most chronic diseases are the long-term result of what we eat and how we live. and they're largely preventable. Okay, now, that's easy to say if I was in my teens or my 20s, you know, and I had made the changes back then. But what if you're already older? Well, I would say it's not too late to make a difference. A healthy diet and lifestyle, even if you adopt it later in life, even if you adopt it after the onset of a disease like the men who had prostate cancer in my study, it may help to prevent, to slow, arrest, or reverse many diseases. I would also point out that many of us have one or another predisposition to develop some condition later in life. And these predispositions may have to do with, you know, genetic inheritance, something we were exposed to prior, earlier physical or emotional trauma. We all accumulate these dings, these issues, as we go through life. But while they may make us more susceptible, they don't often guarantee that we will have full-blown disease just because you have a susceptibility. There needs to be a cofactor. That predisposition can be likened to a seed, but the water still needs to be poured on it to grow a disease. And that water, I would submit, comes in the form of a poor diet and an unhealthy lifestyle. And sometimes, if we deprive the disease, even after it started to grow, of additional water, it'll stop growing and it may even dry up. So the potential for healing, I would think, exists even at a late stage. It's not a guarantee, but there's nothing to lose. Now, another important key to health and longevity, I think, is to think about health span rather than lifespan. I'm sure it's no mystery that longevity is a multi-billion dollar industry, and it tends to feed on the fears of people of getting disease or of not living as long as they imagined. But instead of fixating on diseases or how long we'll live, I think that our focus should be on living healthfully and happily. Some years ago, 1987, a pair of gerontologists, Rowe and Kahn, coined the term health span, and they proposed that we should aim to maintain wellness for as long as possible and as close to the end of life as possible. And they said that if we do this, we're more likely to remain disease and disability free, to have a great quality of life, and to increase our lifespan as a byproduct. One of our final goals, and I kind of learned this a bit from my dad and others, one of our final goals should be to compress morbidity. We're all going to die of something eventually. Maybe we'll be a natural death, but most people have something. But our hope is that that disease only occupies a very short time and toward the very end of life, and that we live well and healthfully up until the last possible moment. And when our time comes, the goal is to experience a peaceful death on our own terms. Now, one last thing I wanted to share, and that is, what constitutes a healthy diet? Because that's a really key, important cornerstone, I think, of healthful aging, and something that I've been immersed in my work. I think a healthy diet has five core principles, call them the five pillars of a healthy diet. It should be based on whole, not refined or processed food. It should be mostly plant-based. Again, doesn't require being a strict vegan or vegetarian, but most of our diet is plant food. It should be locally grown. It should be in season. And now, these aren't perfect things. Sometimes it's hard to find locally sourced things, but as much as possible. And it should be balanced, not just nutritionally balanced, but also aesthetically balanced, a variety of colors and tastes and textures and cooking methods that are involved in our food. Also, we want our primary food groups, plant-based, to emphasize these: whole intact kernel, whole grains and vegetables. Grains have been much maligned because they're confused with gluten, which they don't necessarily connect with. Some do, but many don't. Or because they're confused with white flour products. Whole grains are the opposite end of the spectrum, and they're quite nourishing. Vegetables, a wide variety with an emphasis on dark green and leafy green vegetables, which are excellent for heart health and cancer. Beans and legumes, fruit, seeds, nuts. Secondary food groups, healthy animal foods. So if you're eating food of animal origin, aim for cold water, wild, small fish, for pasture-raised poultry, and so forth, not for commercial feedlot, things that are pumped with hormones or things that will get into us. We also want to have certain primordial foods, things like seaweed and mushrooms. These have all kinds. Seaweed, for example, contains every mineral required by the human body because it's bathing in ocean water, and we evolved out of the ocean, and our biochemistry links to the mineral balance of the oceans. So seaweed is a wonderful food for that purpose. We want to have fermented foods, not so much probiotic supplements, but probiotic foods that are going to give us a diverse array of microbes to help diversify our gut microbiome, to inoculate it with these things. And the other plant foods provide the vermish, the nourishment for microbes. And this is the way to grow a healthy, diverse microbiome. We want to also have green and herbal teas. And so you may be putting this all together and saying, well, okay, brilliant, cold porridge and stale bread again. But actually, it doesn't have to be this way. A whole food plant-based cuisine is diverse and beautiful, appealing to the eyes, to the palate, very satisfying. And here are just a few examples of things that we teach and teach how to cook in some of our cooking classes. Congee, which is an ancient porridge made of slow-cooked intact kernel grain. I have congee every morning for breakfast. Kidney bean stew. Curried vegetable medley. A side of a seaweed wakame salad. How about a berry cashew cheesecake without the moo in it? And one of my favorites, greens a la Caldwell, dedicated to Caldwell Esselstyn, the surgeon from the Cleveland Clinic I mentioned, because he emphasizes every day his heart disease patients having servings of dark leafy greens, lightly cooked. We teach a lot of these things in our program. This is a shameless plug in our program in integrative nutrition through UCSD Extension. That's my colleague, Lorraine McElhern. She and I co-run this program. If anybody's interested for more info, here's some of our contact info for the Centers for Integrative Health, for the Krupp Center for Integrative Research, named after Dick Krupp, who endowed us with a major gift, Ms. Leslie Sebastian, who's actually here today, and yours truly. Anyway, thank you very much. Appreciate your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.